Good morning. Nice to see you. Always enjoy coming down. It's fun to not be here in October. I think the first time I ever came to Belmar would have been about 1984, 85. I came in June, so I remember that. But a little bit more current than all that ancient history is, I have been, since the beginning of this year, spending time in the book of Job. I'd like you to turn to the book of Job. I tend in my devotional practice, not that anybody has to care, but I tend to pick a book of the Bible and read it for a month and then go on to another book. And around last November, I started to read Job and got to the end of the month and read through the book a number of times. And then I spent December in Job, and I was really enjoying Job. So I thought, as long as I was enjoying it so much, that around, I guess it would have been in March, I started to actually teach the book in a number of different places, and I made my way up about halfway through the book. But instead of jumping into where I left off, I'd like you to go to the beginning of the book. Job is a great book, but I find as I read the book, it's really difficult to appreciate someone else's suffering. I don't know what your experience is with someone else's suffering. I guess I prefer someone else's to my own. But, it's always, I find myself when I'm confronted with a person who's going through something really difficult, I find myself searching my own memory banks to see what I could have had that may have been as bad as what they have. And I have this uncanny ability that within seconds, maybe 30 seconds, I can turn the discussion from them and their trouble to me and my trouble. Do you ever do that? And then I leave after talking their arms and legs off for a half an hour saying, you know, what was it that they were having a problem with? You know, the book of Job is kind of interesting because most of the book of Job is wrong. Most of the words in the book of Job are bad theology. Those counselors who come to visit Job don't believe them. Most of the time, they're wrong. So why would God, in his wisdom, and as he inspired the author of Job, whoever that was, to write these words down, why would he have inspired him to include so much bad theology? It's important to consider. But it's hard for us to appreciate someone else's sufferings, and that's what we see a lot of in the book of Job. We all know of people who've suffered tremendous things. Maybe you have as well. I guess my temporal suffering is nothing compared to people I know. When I first moved to New Jersey, I worked at a mission organization who was kind of a sending agency for missionaries in the southern part of Africa. And there was a woman there that I really liked her. She was a great woman. And come to find out after I knew her for a while, was she had a daughter living at home who had been in a coma since the middle of her junior year of high school. One morning, she just didn't wake up, and she had a brain tumor and was comatose. Nobody knew it was coming, and by now, this girl, when I knew the mother, this girl would have been about in her first year of college, but instead, she was at home in bed. As I got to know this woman better, I found out that she had a son who was in a freak accident in Germany while he was in the military, nothing to do with combat. They got a call one morning that something had happened and her son was killed. So she had a daughter who was home in a coma. She had a son who was killed in this freaky accident in Europe. And soon after her son's funeral, she found out that she was in the advanced stages of a certain type of cancer. I thought, wow. It wasn't long and into that first year that I lived here that her daughter died. And when I spoke to her about that, I said, what was harder for you, your son's death or your daughter's death? I was kind of thinking, you know, the girl had been in a coma for going on 3 years. And she said, you know, it was my daughter's death that was so much harder. And within a year, she was with the Lord herself. I got to tell you, it's hard to enter into someone else's suffering. I have no idea what to compare that to. Was she a believer? Yes, she was. Was she a godly believer? Tremendously. Was she immune from adversity? No. Not at all. I was in Michigan recently visiting family. And as I was there, I had opportunity to hang out with some of my good friends from back in the day. And a couple of friends that I was with, people my age or a little bit older, whose children were my kids' age or a little bit older, talking to them, sitting out on their different in their homes, yakking, finding out these are Christian folks who truly love the Lord, and finding out about some of their kids who aren't going on for Christ at all, not even interested in the things of Christ. It's hard to enter into someone else's adversity. It may be a little bit less daunting, but potentially just as crippling is that godly young man or woman who's desperately wanting a Christian boyfriend or girlfriend, and eventually to have a spouse, and there's no one there. No one. Godly people, yes. Immune from adversity? No. Now, the point of this morning's message, as we look through, kind of take a quick look at Job chapter 1 and maybe some other parts of the book, is that because godliness does not immunize us from adversity, believers need to remember, this is important, we need to remember that God is really good, even when life seems really bad. Not all that profound, is it? We know that. That God is really good, even when life seems really bad. Adversity. Let's take a look at this book, this chapter 1. What's a very easy thing to forget when you study Job or when you read Job, but we have to remember is, number one, Job was a righteous man. Now, we know this from the book itself, but it's so easy to forget his righteousness as we listen to his counselors and as we consider our theology of man. You know, if you're almost totally unfamiliar with the book of Job, and many of you may be, if you're totally unfamiliar with this book, you know that Job suffered lots. And you know that he was patient. I guess anyone would know that. You know, the patience of Job is a figure of speech, even in English. Now, if you know the book, you know that pretty soon into the book, his three friends are going to accuse him of hiding some secret sin, of sinning in such a way that God can't help but slap him around for it. They accuse him of pride. They accuse him of arrogance. And as we read the book, we're probably at about chapter 18 when we start to agree with them. But that's wrong. You see, throughout all of those arguments, they insist that Job is sinning. But Job insists that he's innocent. Now, Job would never say, I've never sinned. Job would say, I'm not a sinner. No. But in their crazy theology that we have since come to call retribution theology, they have this concept that if you see something bad happening, that's proof positive of sin. That's dangerous enough, but where that theology got even more dangerous was they would say, if you see something good happening, that's proof positive of someone's righteousness. Kind of crazy, isn't it? I'd like to say that we're not prone to those conclusions, but we are. We make those conclusions all the time. We're with a friend whose kids aren't going on for Christ, and we get in the car and leave and say, boy, I always knew those parents were idiots. Maybe not. Maybe not. It's interesting in the book of Job that the author of the book, chapter 1, verse 1, attests to Job's righteousness. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was what? Pure and upright. One who feared God and turned away from evil. This book was obviously written after this entire account. And there's no indication that Job had ever fallen off the walking with God wagon. He hadn't. He was a righteous man. Pure and upright. He feared God and he turned away from evil. It's interesting, too, as you look through the book, that God himself attested to Job's righteousness. Chapter 1, verse 8. So the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a pure and upright man, one who fears God and turns away from evil. That's God himself speaking. Chapter 2, verse 3, after a bunch of his nightmares, God says, and he still holds firmly to his integrity. Here's a righteous man. The end of the book in chapter 42 in verse 7 and 8, God says that in all of this stuff, Job spoke correctly. And then he says in verse 9 of chapter 42, God says that he accepted Job, that Job was accepted by the Lord. Job was a righteous man. And I'm finding as I study this book that if we let go of that thought, this book makes no sense. Job was a righteous man. But then we find out some more interesting things from this book. We find out that his righteousness, and here's where you got to listen real carefully because it's important. His righteousness did not spare him from personal calamity. Wow, I'm sure Job wishes it would have. But his righteousness, the daily discipline that Job went through to walk closely with God, the personal expense for him to walk closely with God, the discipline of how he spent his time, the discipline of how he controlled his thoughts, we read about those. All of that did not spare him from personal calamity. Chapter 1, verse 13. Verses 13 through 17, we find that he lost his herds and he lost his servants. You know the story. He lost his herds and he lost his servants. What he lost there was his livelihood. He lost his ability to make money. Now that sounds bad enough, and there's probably some of you here who may have recently been laid off, lost your livelihood. We have a handful of people at our church that they can't seem to find a job. And the house payments are still there. There's no clause that you don't have to make the payments if you lose your job. Job lost his livelihood. But in his case, it wasn't just his job. See, he didn't have a bank account. His savings were his things, his cattle, the crops in the field. He lost his job. He lost his savings. He lost his 401k. Believe me, that was his retirement. He lost it all. In moments, it was gone. Verses 18 and 19 of chapter 1, in addition to losing his livelihood, he lost his loved ones. All of his kids and their spouses were together in one place. Halfway through this book, you're thinking Job is saying, I wish my wife would have been visiting at that point. He lost his loved ones. The building fell on them, and they all died. Righteous man, but an almost amazing amount of personal calamity. Job's response, chapter 1, verse 21, is amazing. He says, after he hears about the death of his children and their spouses, he says, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I will return there. The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. May the name of the Lord be blessed. And in all this, Job did not sin. Nor did he charge God with moral impropriety. Wow. He lost his livelihood. He lost his children. Chapter 2, verses 7 and 8, he lost his health. Boy, how many times have people said in times of trouble, as long as you have your health. Well, he lost that too. I ain't going to go into a lot of Boyle stories. I got a lot of Boyle stories I could tell you. I was in a hospital one time and they messed me up there. It's not my fault. Well, it was my fault I was in the hospital. But as a result, for like 3 years after I was in there, I got boils all over. It was terrible. We'll do Boyle stories some other time. But he lost his health. Now, Job, he was a righteous man, but his righteousness did not spare him from personal calamity. I keep saying that, I'm going to keep saying it, because we think we're wrong, but we think that if we live righteously, God somehow has to keep our teeth filled. No pain if I live for Jesus. The Bible never even hints at that foolishness. But we believe it. He was righteous. His righteousness didn't spare him from personal calamity. Third, his righteousness didn't spare him from what I guess I will call, because I'm really smart, relational adversity. How do you like that term? Any of you suffer from relational adversity? I do. There's a bunch of people I'd like to kill, you see. That's relational adversity, all right? He wasn't spared from that either. Chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. His wife grew to despise him. Chapter 2, verse 9. Then his wife said to him, are you still holding firmly to your integrity? Curse God and die. Now, there are some encouraging words. But he replied, you are speaking like one of the godless women would speak. You gotta love Job. Should we receive what is good from God and not also receive what is evil? And in all this, Job did not sin by what he said. You know, it's a pretty tough hit when those who are closest to us come to despise us. When they begin to believe that our motives are bad, especially when our motives really aren't bad. It's tough when our mates think that our dreams are foolish. Or as in Job's case, when they think that our desire to be faithful to God is stupid as well. Even despicable. That was Job's experience with his wife. Relationships can get so ugly. You guys have been through it. Some of you have been through it personally. Some of you have seen loved ones go through it. Boy, when those divorce papers get served, I've been with people who've actually read what those divorce papers say. Most of it's just boilerplate out of some lawyer's computer. How I have been abused emotionally, on how this woman has despised our loving children. You've read some of this stuff. It's pretty crazy how relationships can turn so very, very ugly. And then the Christian who is served, who is trying to live for God, receives counsel from legal folks as well as even from Christian friends who say, you better fight back. And they write back things through their lawyer, of course, that are even worse than what they receive. And in about 20 minutes, you got two people who know Christ as Savior, who sound like two idiot second graders in a sandbox. Chapter 19, verse 17, Job says this. He says, my breath is repulsive to my wife. Now, this is way before Listerine, okay? So he's not talking about, oh man, my wife thinks I have bad, no. He's saying it repulses my wife that I'm still breathing. That's what he's saying. Have you ever noticed that temptation seems so much easier to give in to when we are hurting or discouraged or feeling rejected by people that we love? People who are important to us. It seems like Satan uses those times of discouragement to really make sin so much easier. That was Job's experience here, but Job remained faithful. And what I find so interesting, he remained faithful not only to God, but he remained faithful to her. In chapter 31, verse 9, he says, if my heart has been enticed by another woman, verse 10, then let my wife turn the millstones for another man and may other men have sexual relations with her. In all of this, he not only remained faithful to God in his words, he remained faithful to his wife in his thoughts. But she grew to despise him. His family grew to despise him. Chapter 19, verse 17, he says, I am loathsome to my brothers. That's not just his friends around him, that's his brothers. There was some real animosity against this man, and even from his family. And in this section in chapter 19, Job is giving this series of, if I am guilty of this type of statements, then let that happen to me. He says, if members, this is chapter 31, verse 31, if members of my household have never said, oh, that there were someone who has not been satisfied from Job's table. He says in verse 32, but no stranger ever had to spend the night outside. for I open my doors to the travelers. Apparently, Job was always being generous to people, to the point that it drove his family nuts. What are you going to give away today, Job? What about us? His family grew to despise him. In chapters 4 through 37, the main part of this book, we see his friends grew to despise him. 2 minutes into the first speech against Job, maybe even less, they're already calling him a sinner and an idiot. He's righteous. His righteousness didn't spare him from calamity. His righteousness did not spare him from this relational adversity. Chapter 29, his righteousness didn't spare him from regret. Boy, I'm getting old. I'm really old, actually. I'm getting older. I'm going to be real old even this summer when I'm coming back in July so I can get one of those pencils. But anyway, what about regret? Do you have any of that? His righteousness didn't spare him from regret. In chapter 29, he says that he missed his life. Boy, he looked back at his life, and what a life it was. And he says to God, I really miss that life. Look what he says, chapter 29. Then Job continued his speech. He said, oh, that I could be as I was in the months now gone, in the days when God watched over me, when he caused his lamp to shine upon my head, and by his light I walked through darkness. Just as I was in my productive time when God's intimate friendship was experienced in my tent, when the Almighty was still with me and when my children were around me, when my steps were bathed with butter and the rock poured out for me streams of olive oil, when I went out to the city gate and I secured my seat in the public square, the young men would see me and they would step aside and the old men would get up and remain standing. The chief men restrained themselves from talking and they covered their mouths with their hands when I showed up. The voices even of the nobles fell silent, and their tongues stuck to the roofs of their mouths. Job was a great guy, and everybody knew it. But because of something that we know from the early chapters, he had nothing to do with. Nothing to do with. Job lost all of that. And in chapter 29, he says that he missed his former life. Rightly so. In chapter 30, we find that he not only missed his life, he missed his God. In verse 20 of chapter 30, I cry out to you, but you don't answer me. I stand up, and you only look at me. You've become cruel to me. With the strength of your hand, you attack me. You pick me up on the wind and make me ride on it. You toss me about in the storm. I know that you're bringing me to death, to the meeting place for all the living. Imagine that in Job's mind, because of some kind of bad theology, and because of some almost unbelievable adversity, Job says, God, I know you're out to kill me. And I know that you can't stand me. And God, I miss you. His righteousness didn't spare him from personal calamity, nor from relational adversity. His righteousness didn't spare him from regret, and his righteousness did not spare him from learning that he still had a long way to go. It's not over yet, Job. You see, at the end of the book, when God talked to him, someday read those verses, those chapters. And when God talks to him, he doesn't yell at him for being a stupid sinner. But he also doesn't say, Job, you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. He didn't say that. When God talks to him, Job learns that while he may have been an obedient and a careful follower of God, he really missed a lot about God in the translation. You see, he knew a lot about God, but he didn't know enough about God to trust him fully. You see, he obeyed God, but he didn't fully trust God. A strong believer, a careful practicer of righteousness, but he learned that his Sunday school answers got him through a lot, but didn't serve to get him through the bad that was thrown at him by Satan. And Job learns in this process, and the end of the book is pretty cool for what it doesn't say. He learned that not only is God glorified by his people's obedience, he learned that God is glorified by his people's simple trust. Job learned through suffering. And with God's visit at the end of the book, I think Job's suffering began to fade into that land of distant memories, the land where the terrible becomes the bearable. Happens, doesn't it? What we think at the time is so terrible. In hindsight, we see was bearable. That's no magic on God's part. That's just the way he works. Job would go back to that place where the temporal, the things of this life, take their place in our priorities a bit below the eternal. And I think as you and I live our lives, there's a constant experience of the temporal, the things we do every day, becoming more important than the eternal. And almost 100% of the time, adversity, if we respond correctly, really helps us to move the eternal back to the top and let the temporal sort out somewhere below the eternal. We need to remember that God is really good, even when life seems really bad. That's kind of what the concept of faith is all about. At least when faith is tested to the very limits like Job's was. And like Job, we need to learn that God's power makes him capable. That his justice makes him dependable. And that his sovereignty makes him trustworthy. Because nothing ever takes him by surprise. Nothing. You know, we got to learn these things earlier rather than later. As I was studying through this book, I had a sermon on the radio that I was listening to. I always listen to when I'm not studying, but here I was. Moody Radio, I get it over the internet. I love that. They have the greatest channel in the world. I was listening to a guy preaching and caught the very end of his sermon. The guy said this: God doesn't give you answers. He gives you himself. I was studying the end of the book of Job where God showed up. And when God showed up, basically what he does, I used to find this troubling, but now it makes sense. When God shows up, he tells Job about himself. He says, Job, this is what I'm like. You know, I kind of laid the foundations of the earth. I didn't even ask you to help. I control the weather. I control the sea monsters, Loch Ness Monster, under the control of God completely. God doesn't give you answers. He never did tell Job Satan started all this. Never told him that. He doesn't give you answers. He gives you himself. He gives you, first of all, a view of himself. That's what he gave Job. And that view says God is great. He gives you a view of the world. But he doesn't tell you how bad the world is. He tells you that he's above it and that he fully controls it. And he gave Job a view of himself, of Job. And he said, Job, you need me. As righteous as you are, as dependable as you are, as faithful as you are, as godly as you are, Job, you still need me. That's what you and I need to grasp. That our life is not a journey towards some godliness that we finally achieve and then we're done. No. I don't care if you've been here 113 years. Never missed a meeting in those 100. And I don't care. You still need God. And you need him just as much as you needed him 5 seconds after you trusted Christ. We all do. Okay, I'm whining now, so we better stop. It's after 12. My apologies. Okay, let's pray. Our Father, it's so good to know that you're so good. I pray that you would help us to remember your goodness no matter how things get around us. We're thankful for how you minister to us. We're grateful for your love, for your compassion, for your friendship. And we really are blessed people. In Jesus' name, amen.